Our first case for argument this morning is Stinson v. Galbert and others, and I believe that we will hear first from Mr. Smokowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. It is the position of Detective Galbert that the facts found by the district court in this case in determining the summary judgment motion do not support the legal conclusion that Detective Galbert was part of any conspiracy or part of any effort to fabricate evidence that he had any knowledge of any false opinions in this case. A brief review of approximately six facts found by the district court, and particularly the following fact, is significant.
Well, before you get too much into that, I can tell you that the court is particularly interested in the Johnson versus Jones question, whether we indeed have appellate jurisdiction at this point. And so I think as you discuss, it's not really the district court finding facts, of course, at this stage. It's the district court looking at the record and trying to see if there is a genuine issue of fact. But it would be helpful, I believe, if you could begin with that point.
The distinction there is that I would submit, Your Honor, and the court is the following. The district court found certain facts about the events of the investigation and, of course, the prosecution of the case. Those facts were not in dispute. It then drew certain legal conclusions. I would submit they are legal conclusions and not factual conclusions about what the jury could find based upon those facts. Well, one of those things was that there was a fabrication.
All right, so I guess the question, in light of the line of cases after Johnson against Jones, is whether a district court finding that circumstantial evidence might prove collusion between Detective Galbert and the two experts is the kind of finding of historical fact that Johnson against Jones was concerned about. That's the sort of fact that if there are genuine issues has to go to a trier fact, or whether it's more like a finding that there's no excessive force, which Plumhoff, other cases have said that's really a legal conclusion and something that does not preclude appellate review.
Well, I feel, I would submit, Your Honor, that it belongs in that latter category, because here what you've got is a legal conclusion about what the jury, and Judge Clover is very explicit about that. He puts his facts in one section and then he says from those facts, certain legal conclusions about the existence of a conspiracy or the existence of knowledge of fabrication can be drawn from those facts. We don't dispute that. We don't dispute those facts, that part of it we don't dispute. We dispute the legal conclusion that he attempts to draw there.
So just to be clear, your feeling is that the underlying facts, taken in the light most favorable to the party opposing summary judgment, simply as a matter of law, couldn't yield a conclusion that there was agreement?
That's correct, and one of those legal conclusions that I believe Judge Clover draws in the latter portion of his opinion is that the expert opinions changed right after the meeting.
Why is that a legal conclusion?
Well, I think that's the legal, even if it is, well, strike that. I believe that's a legal conclusion because it's drawing from those facts that are undisputed that there was a change.
So all inferences are legal?
In this particular case, yes, Your Honor, and here is why. I agree that that's an unusual circumstance, but that's part and parcel of that conspiracy claim or that knowledge claim, that the change occurred right after, and of course it didn't.
Well, I guess, I'll let you continue in a minute, but I just want to say there are some things that the Supreme Court has said are important enough to the core Fourth Amendment, let's say, such as the excessive force example I gave a minute ago, that even though you might call them mixed questions, you might put any label you want, the court has said this is something that really should be decided as a matter of law. So fine, we follow that for Johnson versus Jones purposes. There are other things that, I mean, I'm calling them historical facts, whether proven by direct evidence or by inference, that are the sort of thing that we let juries resolve. And I guess I'm having trouble with the idea that all inferences from one set of historical facts take you directly over to a question of law.
Well, let me just elucidate the six facts again that I think are important here. You may recall, the body was found on November 3rd of 1984. Sometime between November 3rd and November 6th, when the detectives meet, when they meet with Stinson and his brother, there is apparently an unreported meeting with Dr. Johnson and the provision of some kind of sketch by him about the teeth. They then go meet Stinson, as I said, on the 6th, and it is after that that they meet again on approximately either November 15th or 16th, somewhere in that range, and produce the report, and the district court finds at that point, Dr. Johnson says he will do another sketch with the police artist. That's the one that's in the district court opinion. It's identified at page 8 and 9 of that opinion as being a sketch that was done after the meeting. And that sketch is inconsistent with his teeth after the meeting. And so from the facts that are undisputed there, there's this legal conclusion that a jury could find from those facts that there has been some kind of collaboration, conspiracy effort to change an opinion. But the opinion is not changed that day. It's apparently not changed until Dr. Johnson sees, and this is of course the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, it doesn't change until there's a John Doe proceeding, apparently. And that is apparently, according to the record, where for the first time, Dr. Johnson, according to the facts most favorable to the plaintiff, says these teeth can be consistent with what I have sketched out.
So your opponent, maybe you can help, on page 7 of the red brief.
Oh, I'm sorry, page 7 of what?
Page 7 of the red brief, the brief of Stinson.
Yes.
Is referring to the undisclosed earlier meeting, not the November 15 meeting, I think it's the November 7 meeting. Dr. Johnson showed Galber and Jacqueline a drawing that he had prepared depicting what he believed to be the dentition of the person who bit the victim. And the district court saying that that drawing is the one that conflicts with what later is used.
Actually, the district court says that that drawing and the later drawing are consistent with one another and that they both conflict. If you look at
All right, go on.
And so it's from those undisputed facts that we submit the court should not have reached a conclusion as a matter of law that a jury could find from those facts that there's been a conspiracy or that there has been some coercion or whatever powers that the detective would have had, or at least an acknowledgement from an expert to the detective that what they were doing was not correct or truthful. In fact, we submit, Your Honors, that this case is consistent with what we cited in Burke and the like, where there is no knowledge of falsity and therefore no serious qualified immunity. And that's why the legal argument is here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr.
Frasco,
is that close?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. I will address the jurisdictional issue because it's Dr. Johnson's position that the jurisdictional issue was correctly decided by the panel in this case. And in fact, Johnson v. Jones, according to the panel, was not overruled by subsequent decisions, but in fact the panel determined that it should be determined in light of subsequent decision, which is not at all an uncommon idea. The Sixth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit have both specifically referenced both the Ricard case and the Harris case in basically cabining or in interpreting the scope of Johnson v. Jones.
Can you explain exactly how you think they restrict somehow the Johnson v. Jones finding?
Well, they draw a distinction. They don't restrict the application per se, but they draw a distinction between those cases. For example, the Sixth Circuit in Roberson v. Torres says Plumhoff appears to cabin the reach of Johnson to purely factual issues that the trial court might confront if the case were tried. Now, there are, Mr. Stinson raises several of these issues in his petition for review, and he uses these as examples for how the panel erroneously expanded its reach to revisit or disregard the plaintiff's key facts. And these facts that he cites are the district court's determination that Dr. Johnson had a meeting with the detectives.
So I'm looking at Plumhoff. The issue of Plumhoff is whether officers used excessive force in violation of the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And as I read that decision, the court is quite clear that this is a legal issue. And thus, certainly something that doesn't preclude a sort of barons against Peltier collateral order review. Why do we have a legal issue here?
Well, in this case, it's specifically that. In the Johnson v. Jones...
It's not excessive force. Why is the question whether, you know, there's a November 7th meeting, there's an agreement at that meeting to frame Mr. Stinson, however unlikely that may be. I mean, I'm not expressing anything about whether that ultimately would be a finding or not. Of course not. It's not my place to express that opinion now. But why isn't that a fact question?
Well, those findings are not challenged on this appeal. Dr. Johnson does not challenge the findings.
He does challenge that there's an agreement.
Well, he challenges.
Why is the question whether they come to an agreement a legal question?
Well, Dr. Johnson challenges whether or not the facts found here are significant enough or apply to a due process claim. The due process claim here is that he fabricated opinions that were then used at trial. Those opinions were due to his work in this case. And as the panel found, that Stinson bases his claims that the opinions were fabricated almost solely on the expert opinions of the Innocence Project panel and on Dr. Bowers.
As I understand it, the other side of this is that there's the opportunity to agree, they get together early, the experts later say no competent odontologist could possibly have mistaken, you know, the teeth the way they were, there were other things about the bite marks, and from that they say a reasonable trier of fact could infer that there was this fabrication based on this agreement.
But that all comes back to the fact that a due process challenge is a trial right. The allegation is that Dr. Johnson violated Mr. Stinson's right to a fair trial. Dr. Bauer's criticisms are that his opinions were fabricated. We have to understand Dr. Johnson was not a lab person. He was not doing a serology report. He's not ensconced in the lab. He was not hiding evidence. His job was as a testimonial forensic expert who looked at evidence in front of himself, came to an opinion, wrote down all of his work product, and then conceivably, and the district court found this, turned over all of his work product, every single piece of material that he looked at after he made his subjective determinations to the other side and said, that's what I base it on, here it is, and that is undisputed. None of that was changed. None of the material he based his opinions on was fabricated.
That's their theory, actually. I think their theory is all of that is based on his earlier decision that he's going to produce a report favorable to the prosecution.
Well, the actually meeting with the detective in its in and of itself is not a constitutional violation. Nor is, as Dr. Bowers takes issues with, the fact that he eliminated several other potential suspects by looking at photographs. That in itself is also not a constitutional violation. The question is here is whether we concede that any of that stuff happened, that he did meet with the detectives, that he did write this report, that he did eliminate other people. Did he violate a due process right, a citizen's right to a fair trial in this case?
So you would agree as a matter of theory, in some other case, not your case, that fabrication of evidence or giving a dishonest opinion, saying my opinion is that it was A's teeth instead of B's, would violate due process?
Well, not a violation of an opinion. That's where this case is different from everything else. Violation of a testimony.
In some hypothetical case, I don't want you to have feel that you have to say anything about your client, but in some hypothetical case, do you agree that lying about your opinion and saying it's my opinion that it's A's teeth when you really realize it couldn't possibly be A, would that, in your view, violate due process?
Well, actually, that is where the Booley v. McAdory case and the Sornberger case come in, because the problem there is if you're coming to an opinion that's false or that's so-called fabricated, the violation is when that opinion is admitted at trial without the protections of things like Brady. And in this case, as the determination was made by the panel, there was no Brady violation here. The material is conceded by Mr. Stinson that all of the material upon which these allegedly fabricated opinions was turned over, as was a list of potential experts containing more than 50 board-certified odontologists, was turned over to Mr. Stinson's counsel. He had his own expert who did not testify at trial. These were all recognized by the district court, and they were all the underlying factual basis for the panel's decision in this
case. All right, so I wonder if we could get back to appellate jurisdiction, because what you're arguing is that maybe he went to trial, and actually we're here on whether we should have a qualified immunity appeal.
Excuse me?
So you're arguing he should win a trial, but I'm interested in whether we should have a qualified immunity appeal at this time.
I believe we should, Your Honor. For instance, this is not a case like Johnson v. Jones, where the actual the claim of whether something actually happened was the detective in Johnson v. Jones claimed that there was not sufficient evidence even to place them at the scene here. Dr. Johnson's not saying that he was not there, he did not have that meeting. He's just saying that we take that as a given, and even then, he's entitled.
Counsel, I thought Dr. was saying that at this point that his opinion was honestly mistaken. The district judge found that it would, or one could reasonably infer that it was fabricated. Why isn't that just a factual question we would submit to a jury?
So I'm sorry, Your Honor, which fact?
The choice between negligence and lying.
Mm-hmm. Because there is no evidence to establish that there was, other than the detectives, and none of the cases cited say that you can draw a permissible inference of a constitutional violation solely because an expert says, I think they used improper methodologies and their conclusions were wrong based on those improper methodologies.
So the argument is that the evidence does not support the inference of lying, right?
The evidence...
That's your argument.
The evidence does not, the expert evidence does not, and that's the only evidence that indicates that there is a so-called fabrication here.
Is there any evidence of the doctor's subjective intent?
Sorry?
Is there any evidence of the doctor's subjective intent as opposed to an objectively unreasonable opinion?
There's no evidence objectively.
I'm talking about subjective intent. What is the evidence? The difference here is that a fabrication claim requires evidence of the defendant's subjective intent rather than just an objectively mistaken opinion. What we've got is a contrary expert opinion put in by Stinson's counsel that the doctor's opinion was grossly mistaken. And according to the standards of forensic odontology, unreasonable. but we don't have any real evidence of his subjective intent, and there has to be at least some evidence that Dr. Johnson and Dr. Rawson knew that Stinson wasn't the killer and made up their opinion anyway. That's what a fabrication claim requires. Do we have any evidence from which a jury could infer that?
No, Your Honor. Dr. Johnson takes the position we do not have any evidence that he subjectively had that. In fact, the fact that he turned over the all of the evidence belies that assumption or that conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Maloney.
Good morning. May it please the Court. It appears that the Court is particularly interested in the jurisdiction question, so I will address that if that would be pleasing to the Court. As counsel for Dr. Johnson told the Court, we don't believe that Johnson was overruled by Plumhoff or by Scott, just that there's a need to take into consideration what was held in Plumhoff and in Scott.
Would you speak louder, please?
I'm sorry, of course. It's important to recognize that there's no evidence that Dr. Rawson was involved in these meetings that occurred early on in November that has been an issue of discussion with regard to Dr. Johnson. Dr. Rawson's first involvement in this matter did not occur until January of 1985. By the time Dr. Rawson became involved in this case, District Attorney Blinka had already determined that he had evidence to charge and to convict Stinson of the crime.
Am I correct that Dr. Rawson provided his expert opinion one day before the start of the trial?
What happened, Your Honor, is the detectives flew to Las Vegas with the evidence, and Dr. Rawson rendered a preliminary opinion regarding the evidence that Dr. Johnson had created.
And that report was based on a two-hour review in the hotel room of the detectives?
No, Your Honor. In March, Dr. Rawson requested and received the materials that Dr. Johnson had prepared, and at that time prepared a very detailed analysis of the materials. So it's not accurate, in my opinion, to say that he based his opinion on that very early, short review of the evidence. He did take a very detailed review of the evidence. And Dr. Rawson's position in this case was to review Dr. Johnson's opinions and conclusions and evidence and come to a conclusion as to whether or not Dr. Johnson's conclusions and the evidence that he created was indeed correct.
But would I also be correct if I believed from what I read that the district attorney was unwilling to bring charges based on Johnson's opinion alone and decided to file charges only after learning that Dr. Rawson concurred with Johnson's opinion?
That is correct, Your Honor. Attorney Blinka did conduct a John Doe proceeding, and he was convinced at that point in time that he probably had enough evidence to indict and probably convict Mr. Stinson, but to err on the side of caution, he requested this second opinion. It's my understanding that Assistant District Attorney Blinka had been made aware of Dr. Rawson's scholarly works, and that is how the communication with Dr. Rawson came about.
You see, I ask because Dr. Rawson contends that he can't be considered a complaining witness because he did not play a sufficient role in initiating the prosecution. But if the district attorney was unwilling to bring charges based on Dr. Johnson's opinion alone, why would that be insufficient to characterize Dr. Rawson as a complaining witness?
Because Dr. Rawson was only reviewing the adequacy and the correctness of Dr. Johnson's investigation and his creation of the bite mark evidence.
It was both Blinka and Johnson
that suggested Dr. Washington, is that right?
I believe that's correct. My understanding is...
I'm sorry, Blanca wanted to follow. Both of them agreed that there should be a follow-up, and I guess it was Johnson that said Lawson needs to be a top expert.
Well, it turned out Dr. Lawson and Dr. Johnson were passing acquaintances as a result of each of them being diplomats in the odontologist academy. And but it's my understanding of the facts that Attorney Blinka was familiar with Dr. Lawson's work as a result of Dr. Lawson's preparation of scholarly, of at least one scholarly journal, which was introduced at the trial of Mr. Stinson. So returning back to the jurisdiction question, it seems to me that the ruling in Newsom decided in 2003 that absolute immunity for testimony and preparation should be granted, and the evidence must be taken in a light most favorable to Stinson. So the, in that case, it was found that the question boils down to whether or not conduct violating a constitutional right, it has to be determined, and that is a question for the bench. So that's why, in my opinion, this is a question of law that should be taken up on the order for qualified or absolute immunity.
So the district court recognized, though, that trial testimony is privileged, and our panel opinion indeed took that same position, that this is not the realm for absolute immunity, but that this was activity in conjunction with the investigation. Are you taking issue with that aspect of the panel's decision?
With all due respect, I do believe that there is a distinction to be made between Dr. Johnson and Dr. Lawson regarding investigation. I think that given the fact that the district attorney had made the determination that he had sufficient evidence to charge and probably convict Mr. Stinson, takes Mr. Lawson out of that category of investigation.
The case wasn't charged until after Lawson rendered his opinion.
Correct. Mr. Lawson gave his initial opinion in January. Mr. Stinson was charged in January, but then Mr. Lawson did undertake that more extensive examination in March.
Right, but the claim here focuses on the investigative activity, the pre-charging activity. So absolutely, it does not apply.
I've wrestled with that, Your Honor. I really have. But I think that the fact that Mr. Lawson really was not creating evidence, he wasn't involved in interviewing witnesses, he never went to the scene, he was very tangential to the investigation. His role here was to check on the accuracy and the correctness of Dr. Johnson's work.
Right, but 88 Blanca was not going to charge the case until he had a second opinion.
Correct, you're right, Your Honor. Okay, the other undisputed facts that I think gives Dr. Lawson an immunity is that I mentioned that he was not involved in interviewing witnesses or going to the scene of the crime or participating in the interrogation. Dr. Lawson is very, his activity is very similar to the experts in Buckley, and their conduct is very similar.
I'm sure you want to go there. The expert in Buckley was known for fabricating her opinions.
Yes, I know, Your Honor.
Okay, so maybe you want to stay away from that.
It's a friendly suggestion.
I will take that to the table. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kavitz?
Good morning, may it please the Court. Mike Kavitz for the plaintiff appellee, Robert Stinson. Your Honors, the question of what intent a person has in their heart and in their head is classically a question of fact.
But there are summary judgments granted all the time, even though women discrimination cases, people talk about intent. Surely, if we were to look at this record and say that no prior fact in its right collective mind or in its right individual mind could find that there was the kind of activity that you're talking about, then we would have something that's teed up for appropriate appellate review at this point.
Correct. I mean, if the trial court looked at the record, in, which consisted of over 130 exhibits that it studied intensely, depositions, affidavits, expert reports, and said, looking at all of this and imagining what a jury, a reasonable jury could decide, I don't think that there is sufficient evidence to find intentional fraud as opposed to a mistake, then yes, we would be up here on a final order arguing to you, please go back and look at those 130 odd exhibits and get into the very nitty-gritty details of what the evidence sufficiently might show. But that's not the posture that we're in. We're in the classic Johnson versus Jones posture, which tells us when a district court has made findings on the sufficiency of the evidence in a collateral order appeal, which is a judicially created doctrine, not something that Congress has authorized, you stick only to abstract legal questions. And sufficiency of the evidence is never an abstract legal question.
Well, doesn't it depend on what the question is? Because the Supreme Court, in this whole line of cases, whether it's Harris, whether it's Plumhoff against Rickert, has identified, I mean, excessive force is kind of a fact-sounding question, but it isn't.
Yes, exactly right. I think that the question...
Why not here? Why not? Why don't we have a question like that?
Because I think you hit the nail on the head. The question of objective reasonableness, whether it's probable cause or excessive force, the question of objective reasonableness...
You're not that much of a hurt.
The question of objective reasonableness is quintessentially a question for a judge. We often write it into jury instructions because we don't know what the facts are from which to draw that conclusion. But in a stipulated fact situation, a judge can look at the stipulated facts and draw that conclusion, and it would be...
Well, it doesn't need to be a stipulated fact pattern.
No.
If the facts accepted in the light most favorable to the plaintiff and construed in his favor aren't sufficient to give a jury a reasonable factual basis to make the necessary legal conclusion to find liability, then summary judgment is appropriate. And that's what we've got here, a question about whether a reasonable fact finder, a reasonable jury, could find knowledge of falsehood. In other words, that both of these forensic odontologists knew that Stinson was not the killer and made up their opinions that he was, with that knowledge. In other words, that they were lying when they said in the investigative phase of the case that his dentition matched the killer's. And I see no subjective intent evidence in this record. There is an expert opinion, a very persuasive expert opinion from your expert and the Innocence Project board that this set of opinions was grossly mistaken. But that's not enough for a willful fabrication claim under our cases. What evidence of subjective intent is there, as opposed to gross negligence?
So, several points in response to that. First of all, the second the court is saying that's not enough, the court is performing a sufficiency of the evidence review. So you have to look at Johnson versus Jones to ask if you have jurisdiction to do that at all. That would be my first point. And under Johnson versus Jones, I think it's very clear that the court doesn't. But my second point would be that we don't have to have direct evidence of what motive somebody harbored in their heart.
Correct, but you need some circumstantial evidence of subjective intent.
And I believe that our record is rich in circumstantial evidence.
So maybe you could just give, four or five ticks of what you think your best circumstantial evidence is of... that would allow a trier of fact to infer deliberate fabrication.
Certainly. I'll raise them chronologically in the course of the story. First of all, we know that at a point in time before Mr. Stinson became the suspect, the forensic examiner made a determination of dentition that did not match Mr. Stinson. Then, after Mr. Stinson became the suspect, he changed that determination. That is a fact that adds a great deal to what we get from a panel of experts, which is not just this opinion is mistaken, but that given what forensic examiners of that type knew at the time, we don't see how you could look at this evidence and draw any conclusion other than that there was not a match.
So when you say the forensic examiner, you mean Dr. Johnson looks first and says, I forget which, it's the front tooth, and then it turns out to be the lateral, or the other way around, yeah. The lateral, and it turns out to be the front,
right. Yeah. Exactly. And so there are actually some of your sister courts have said that the type of expert opinion we have alone is enough to create circumstantial evidence for a jury to decide whether the forensic examiner was fabricating or not. But we have more than that. We have the switch. We have the cover-up of the switch. You know, we have a set of police reports that are supposed to be completely describing what these investigators did during their investigation, and they leave out the part where the forensic examiner had a different opinion to start with.
Well, that switch, did he have more information?
Pardon?
The switch you're calling it. Did he have more information, more study, that he realized that there was some disparity?
Two points, Judge. One is he did not have more information, and two, he's never claimed that it was just a question of reevaluating the evidence.
Well, at what point was the switch?
The change took place by November 15th, because we know from the police report that they created on November 15th, before the John Doe hearing ever happened, but after the police knew that they had Stinson, that's when the change occurred.
Between the 7th and the 15th?
6 and 15th, yes.
The district court in this case said that the facts support a reasonable jury finding that Johnson phrased the request for a second opinion as a request for confirmation of his own conclusion, and Dr. Rawson complied.
Yes.
Which is, I assume you rely on that in part in your chronology of.
As to Dr. Rawson, for sure.
What subjective intent can we find that he could lobby a colleague of which he has some familiarity with to lie and fabricate in this case? Well,
so
how can someone draw? What else is there? I understand the meeting with Johnson and the detectives is a cornerstone of your argument, but what about this with Rawson, where he brings it into the case? He's the one who contacts Rawson.
Correct. It's Johnson that contacts Rawson.
Yeah, so he just calls a colleague and says, I want you to join the conspiracy here, and back me up on mistaken analysis. Is that really what the district judge is saying here?
The district judge is saying that the evidence could support that finding of fact. And the district judge is relying more on just the bone.
I was wondering, what would we have for that, other than that he called him and asked him to confirm? Is that alone enough to have Mr. Rawson in this case?
No, but there were several more pieces of evidence that the court relied on to be able to say that a reasonable jury could find that. First of all, when Johnson decided to bring Rawson in, he said, I want the best guy out there to confirm my findings. Okay, so there's a good basis to infer that Rawson knew what Johnson's findings were before he ever received the evidence.
Why is that a reasonable inference?
Pardon?
Why is that a reasonable inference? Isn't that how these people talk? I want somebody to confirm this before we go forward with it. You know, it's not reasonable to say that that's subjective intent of willful fabrication. That's just an unreasonable inference that you're suggesting.
Well, take it in isolation, but to decide what the reasonable inferences are, we have to look at the entirety of the record.
Right, and accepting everything that you say occurred, and a true Johnson versus Jones fact-based appeal, which is precluded in qualified immunity law, you've got to have an appeal that is relying on a dispute of historical fact. In other words, what occurred step by step. So the defendants are all saying, we're willing to accept everything that you said in your case about what occurred as a chronological matter of historical fact. And even accepting all of that, there isn't enough here for a jury to infer subjective intent. And that's a pure legal question about whether a reasonable jury could make that inference. Takes it into Plumhoff and outside of Johnson versus Jones.
What I would say is, first of all, there is more evidence that I would like to speak about that supports that inference. And secondly, inferences are part and parcel of what Johnson said has to be accepted on a qualified immunity appeal. So the fact that the court did reach those inferences means that you should not be revisiting them. The court.
Reasonable inferences. Plumhoff tells us that if the inference that you're suggesting is unreasonable, that's not worthy of crediting. I mean, that was the videotape chase case.
Scott was
the videotape chase case. Plumhoff was similar. It was building on what Scott said.
Scott, to the extent that that represents the outer lines of Johnson, Scott said it has to be blatantly apparent from the record. Blatantly apparent means immediately apparent. We're digging in, we're wading into the record here to try to figure out what inferences might be. We have to study, if we're going to do a fair job of it, we've got to study over 130 exhibits to ask ourselves, when the jury hears all this evidence, what might a reasonable jury decide?
So what else do you have other than the request?
We have the nature of the review that Rawson did before he was willing to say, quote, that's good enough for me, I'm going to back up what Johnson said. And the quote, that's good enough for me, suggests that he does know exactly what it is that Johnson said, because otherwise he wouldn't be saying, I'm going to back it up. He spent as little as 1 hour, rushes to the Vegas hotel room, doesn't examine it in the place where a dentist would, where they can put it up on the backlight and really do a thorough job. He doesn't do a very good job at all. Standing by itself, you could argue that would be gross recklessness, but it has to be taken in context. It's taken in context of the fact that Johnson contacted him before. It's taken in the context of the fact that he's confirming, he said to the police, I confirm what Johnson said, so I did know what Johnson said. It's taken in the context of the fact that...
That's not a blind review, you're saying. They don't just come in and say, look at these films and this stuff and tell us what you think.
Exactly, which is actually...
saying, I'm confirming what somebody else thinks, so it's not blind.
Exactly, which is interesting because the reason why we couldn't get, or Mr. Stinson wasn't able to hire a bite mark expert is because each of the bite mark experts that they contacted said, we've heard Rawson and Johnson talking about this at out there in the public, so I know what the results were. I can't help you. I can't reverse engineer that. That's why we ended up with a forensic odontologist who was used to doing the identification of human remains. We didn't get a bite mark expert at trial because you can't do it in reverse.
Why is that? Why couldn't a third expert question at the time, called reverse engineering, what was precluding that occurring?
I suppose, and I don't know the answer, but what I would imagine is that this is pattern analysis, and if a pattern has been suggested to you, you might see that pattern where you wouldn't otherwise.
But you mean that the ball's always rolling downhill after two experts and a third expert? If you don't have any experience in patent litigation or other areas, it's not hard to find somebody who goes the other way.
No, it's just that we weren't able to find someone who didn't already know what the conclusion was. So
I think there was some allegation that the transparencies were manipulated anyway, that they were put over the wrong part of the impression. Is the picture of the original bite marks in this record?
You can see pictures of the original bite marks in the expert's opinion because they reproduce the picture of the bite mark and then they do the analysis to show how they didn't remotely match.
So this is your expert's
This is the panel from the Wisconsin University.
So what were you supposed to put on this? I think part of your case, as I understand you, is that at some point, if you're wrong enough, a jury could infer that you're being dishonest. So if some doctor says, I'm operating the right leg, it's really the left leg. I mean, at some point, it's just so obviously wrong that an inference of dishonesty could be there. Are you not in that?
I believe that is the law, but we rely on more than simply the fact that they got it unbelievably wrong. I mean, certainly we should listen to what the experts say, which is that when I look at this, I don't see any way possible, Bob experts say, I don't see any way possible for someone who's looked at this using the standards of that time and not realize that there wasn't a match. But we have.
And couldn't possibly mistake the difference between the front tooth and the lateral tooth.
Right, or for that matter, formulate the idea that a broken tooth makes a mark when the adjacent tooth don't make any marks at all. That's a misorientation of the overlays in a way that conceals the fact that there's not a match, or that the molars can make a mark when the teeth in between didn't. So there is that piece of evidence. And like I said, and, you know, like Moldawan and some of the other circuits have said that's enough, but we've got more.
Mr. Friedman, does the record reflect any contact between Dr. Johnson and detectives prior to this investigation, any relationship with the police department, or is their association commenced with this case?
The association with these particular officers, as far as I know, commenced with this case, but the association with the police department was strong because Dr. Johnson had an appointment with the medical examiner's office. So he would have been working on cases where there was an investigation for quite some time. I don't remember how long he held that appointment at the time, but it was of long standing.
Dr. Bowers is also a lawyer, isn't that
right? Pardon?
Dr. Bowers?
Dr. Bowers is our expert in the civil case.
A lawyer also.
I didn't look at his CV to be able to tell.
What?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I thought I read that. That's why I was curious. Is he
they
do a lot of testifying, in other words.
Yeah, he certainly wouldn't be the first expert who also has JD after their name. You know.
But this is the thing is about it's supposed to be so obvious that anybody of any knowledge of the horse, this has to be some kind of intentional distortion. And this is 25 years later, or 23 years later, that this farmer comes in and says, well, even back then they should have known that. Even though way back then, this was not, I don't know what kind of exact science you want to call it, but it was pretty new. In fact, that's why they went to Rawson, because he was perhaps the only one that had some experience with this.
So, Bowers is not the only one who says that it's so wrong that I infer that they must have known. The Wisconsin Innocence Panel says that as well. The Wisconsin Innocence Panel says that as well. It's not just Bowers by himself saying it's so wrong. But again, and I sense the court's discomfort with the idea that one expert saying it's not I see intent here shouldn't be enough. Again, you know, we're under Johnson versus Jones, so I think the second we're asking ourselves, is it enough? We're outside our jurisdiction. But regardless, I need to emphasize, we have more here. I mean, the fact that Johnson initially told Gallagher a dietitian that did not match with Mr. Stinson adds in a substantive way to what the experts are finding separately when they look at the evidence.
You see, this is where I see a lot of opportunity here where they got together and did this and that, and then I guess the thing I keep searching for is something that is intentional, and these people would have a motive to distort this.
Okay.
And that's the hard part. I see that, you know, there's opportunity. They were alone together. They were doing different things. And that's where this, what I call speculation, comes in. And then there's the opportunity. And so a jury, with all of you, say, you know, 130 pages, whatever you said, a whole lot of stuff, the jury ought to be able to find somewhere in there where that really was intentional. And I just want to find that one little nugget where these people had some motive and purpose to disorder this.
So I believe that there is evidence of motive, although I don't believe that that's a required showing for us to make out a claim, but there's certainly motive on Gallagher, who we know from the memo books kept track of every single kid from that Johnson case and what happened to them. So he has a reason to try to lean on the experts. But there's a motive.
The earlier murder case that he thinks.
Yes, correct. And then we know that immediately after this conviction, Johnson, the expert, took his show on the road with the evidence and said, we've got this conviction, let me tell you about bite mark science, and became, you know,
well,
someone
well
and famous for
that's after the fact.
Sure.
That he had some sort of reputation and that ramble that Garvey wrote, this comes into, well, that's just a ramble. Talks about amazing how many murders go unsolved and how many people don't have teeth and things like that. I didn't see any focus back here other than because Betty was the one that had the bite case, and that's where this came up. I don't see the motive, though. When it gets back to purposely distorting it just to get back at Stinson?
I don't think Johnson cared about Stinson one way or the other. He wasn't trying to get back at him. Johnson was trying to match the suspect so that he would then be hired, build 130 hours, and then he would give the testimony. And then I do think that he had in mind that he was going to go on and make a career out of this. Because it was, as you said, urgent.
Could you say, and I find this case very confusing, could you say in one sentence what determination we have to make in order to affirm the district court?
You would need to determine that the intent to fabricate is a question of fact, which the intent to fabricate is a question of fact, which the district court found would be sufficiently supported by the evidence at summary judgment. That resolves this entire appeal because once
can
that
be dismissed for want of jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
Find that there was enough evidence to allow a jury to find intent to fabricate, both on Gallagher's part and on the part of each of the two debtors, then we dismiss under Johnson.
Exactly.
If we find, to the contrary, that no finder of fact could support all of these, the necessary parts of this, then it's teed up for summary judgment. We would have to decide whether on merit, whether it qualifies to be
Great. Well, I would say you have to make a two-stage finding. One is, do you even get to decide if the evidence is sufficient? And then second, is the evidence sufficient? I think it's resolved with the first question, which is under Johnson v. Jones, you accept what the district court found was sufficiently supported. If you
we'll
think
have to review the record to see. I mean, if it was a guy against Harris kind of case, we would say, you know, the district judge may have thought there were disputed issues of fact, but we don't see them. So we do have to look at that.
This is not Scott. Scott set the outer boundaries.
I understand that. I'm just saying you were overstating your case.
Well, fair enough, Judge. But if you found that the facts were blatantly contradicted, which to me means you don't have to wade into the record and try to understand what the expert said.
It's a summary judgment review, basically. If there's enough there to allow a rational jury to find the fabrication with all of the intentional dimensions, then we say no interlocutory appeal.
That is correct, because as to the Brady claim and as to the fabrication claim, it was very well established a long time ago, all the way back to me.
Mr. Kanowitz, Dr. Rawson appears to be the most tangential member of the alleged conspiracy. What is Mr. Stinson's best evidence that he was a conspirator rather than simply grossly incompetent?
The best evidence is that a jury could, from the nature, the incredibly cursory nature of what he did, the conversation with Johnson beforehand, the fact that he said, "I confirmed Johnson's findings sitting there in the hotel room," could confer, just as we saw in the Dickies where there's a nod from a police officer, that's enough to make the inference, because conspiracies are almost never proven by direct evidence.
But Ms. Maloney has argued that Dr. Rawson did a great deal more study.
He did later. But that was after the prosecution was already rolling. So we have to look at, the fact that he was a necessary link in the chain to get the prosecution going. And, you know, there's every reason for a jury to be able to infer that Johnson communicated that to him. So, and I guess
unless you've got the expert opinions from the Innocence Project, which is a huge factor you're relying on, isn't that right?
Absolutely.
Because your bottom line position is that if the opinions of Johnson and Rawson were so out of whack that circumstantially you can infer what their motives were or their intent was.
I think that's absolutely the law, but we also have more. But yes, I mean, it is a staggering thing to have a panel of experts come out and make the kinds of opinions here that these experts do. But we have more. May I conclude?
Sure.
Your Honor, the only question that this court has to ask itself is whether the determination that intentional fabrication is a question of fact, upon answering that question, which of course it is a question of fact, it's quintessentially a question of fact, Johnson versus Jones directs you to concentrate and use that fact for the qualified immunity determination and the absolute immunity determination. And given that that is the fact, in this case, given that the district court found substantial evidence, sufficient evidence in summary judgment to believe that Robert Stinson lost 23 years of his life locked away as an innocent man because of an intentional fraud that misled the prosecutor, the answer is that this appeal must be dismissed. It's time for us to have a trial. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have some reserved time for rebuttal. I think, Mr. Smokowicz, you had a little bit left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there are three points that I need to address here in rebuttal. Try to avoid some confusion here. The first thing is this. I think it's very important to note, although there's been some argument or inference that there was a finding, the district court did not find that there was any agreement among Galber and Johnson, or Galber, Johnson, and Rawson, but particularly involving Galber, to do anything in terms of the fabrication. Secondly, I mean, that would be something that we would have summary judgment for the plaintiff here, as opposed to the potential for defendant's summary judgment here. And
well, are you saying that the jury couldn't infer fabrication, or that it's irrelevant?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that there's insufficient evidence here, given the circumstance that's most crucial as to Detective Galvin in particular, that Mr. Stinson's counsel himself has emphasized here, the four or five points he's talked about intent, and one of them is the change in opinion. And as I pointed out in the initial statement here, the change in opinion didn't occur after the meeting.
How do you deal with those pictures of the teeth?
The pictures of the teeth are pictures of the teeth that were not, there's no evidence that the detective ever saw or knew about them or had any expertise to evaluate them.
You need expertise to
take
pictures of the
team? Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, to be fair to Detective Galber here, Detective Jackman, by the way, is not a defendant because he died in 1989. Detective Galber, he's not an expert. You can see from the record that they actually went out and found other people with missing teeth. I don't think that there's any evidence here that he actually knew exactly what tooth to look for. And that's the circumstance there.
Well, how did the detectives know to look for someone with a missing tooth?
They knew from the
meeting
from,
with Johnson?
They probably knew from the meeting with Johnson that they were looking for someone who was missing a front tooth.
And that initially wasn't disclosed to the defense, right?
Well,
and he didn't, and now he says in his deposition in his book that it happened.
Yes, there was yes and no. There was a report of the interview with Stinson, which indicated that they were looking for someone, and obviously they had to have knowledge of what they were looking for. But what's most curious about that is that afterwards, and after identifying Stinson, and after mentioning that Stinson was out there, Dr. Johnson produces yet another inconsistent sketch. That's the one that's in the court's opinion below. And that's what's so crucial to the plaintiff's claim about intent for Galber, is that this change came immediately after the meeting, when it did not. It is very dangerous, I submit, to hang a case against be it a detective or the dentist themselves on merely a change of an opinion by an expert upon further reflection and analysis. It's akin to saying a lawyer or a judge could never legitimately change his or her mind and continue to be credible, even reaching an opposite conclusion. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. I think your time may have expired, Mr. Frankoviak, but if you'd like just a minute to wrap up, I will give it to you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, just to clarify a factual issue. Dr. Johnson was a private dentist in the private practice of dentistry. He was a professor at Marquette. He did work with the office occasionally, DA, doing identifications and things like that. The counsel said that he took his show on the road afterwards. The allegation here is that he framed a man and then took his show on the road to show how he framed a man. We're talking about whether or not there is a reasonable inference that can be drawn. Reasonable in this case. Whether he changed his opinion, whether he excluded other people at some point, any of the work he did previously, he ultimately has to get these opinions past opposing counsel and has to get them to the jury. Dr. Bowers, Mr. Stinson's own expert, says, I came to opinions, I criticized Dr. Johnson was wrong, he did all these things wrong. I come to that conclusion looking at the same stuff Dr. Johnson looked at, looking at the same stuff Mr. Stinson and his defense counsel had, and anyone worth their salt would have known that in 1985. There was no violation of a due process right here.
Okay, thank you very much. And Ms. Malone.
Thank you. Again, may it please the court. I have just a few points to make in response to the plaintiff's attorney's argument. I would like to reiterate that it's not a reasonable inference to consider a subjective intent that's a pure legal question. There's been no evidence that I've seen in this record to demonstrate that there was indeed a subjective intent to fabricate any evidence. And I would like to reiterate the fact that...
I'm not suggesting, are you, that that can't be, that one can't infer subjective intent, right?
I think that you can, there has to be some basis for inferring the intent. And I don't think that this record demonstrates, but we're taking everything that Mr. Stinson says as true for the purposes of this appeal, but I don't think that he's brought forth anything that would establish a subjective intent to fabricate any evidence. And that's the other point that I think is very important. We're not talking about either Dr. Wasson or Dr. Johnson, for that matter, or anyone in the defendant, of fabricating evidence. We're talking about fabrication of an opinion. And I think that that's something that makes a difference in this case.
Fabrication of an opinion? I haven't heard that expression before. What do you mean by that?
There's
no... The office opinion that's a lie? Is that what you mean by fabrication of an opinion?
The claim in this case is not that Dr. Johnson or Dr. Rawson created physical evidence that would implicate Mr. Stinson in this crime. Their claim is that Dr. Rawson and Dr. Johnson fabricated an opinion that the dentition for Mr. Stinson matched the dentition on the victim.
How do you fabricate an opinion?
Yeah, you lie, right?
You don't lie, you can...
Now, wait a second. You don't lie, you fabricate an opinion, that's a lie, right? You made up something that you know is false. That's what fabrication
is. It's just the allegation. I mean, the allegation is that he knew it wasn't really Stinson, but he said that it was Stinson.
But there's no evidence that he created evidence to fabricate that it was Stinson.
Wrote an expert opinion before we used the trial. All right, thank you very much. Many thanks to all counsel. The court will take this case under advisement and we will recess briefly.